Hello, hello. Welcome to House Einstein Podcast 30. And we are recording this in early January in Boulder, Colorado. Our intention is to help you make a smarter real estate decision. That is what we do at House Einstein. And in this podcast, we're going to be talking about inspection concessions. We're going to talk about the sale of the week, current events at House Einstein, a decision that sellers often face, whether they should sell or possibly rent their property. We'll go into some of the pros and cons of being a landlord. And then if you are willing to stick around for the entire podcast, at the end we're going to talk about Jay-Z and Beyonce's latest acquisition in Malibu, which you may have read about. It's a hot topic because it was the most expensive real estate transaction in the United States last year at $190 million for a personal residence.
Yeah. Big numbers.
Big numbers. But you'll have to wait to the end for that. If you are new to the podcast, my name is Osman, and I'm the founder of House Einstein. I've been in the real estate world for about 20 years, and before that, I worked in the investment community.
I'm Hamish Crabb. I help the team at House Einstein. I help keep the brokerage running smoothly from contracts to marketing, kind of take care of it all. I've been here for 2 years now and just excited to see where this goes.
Hopefully we have an amazing year. We're always happy to have you, Hamish.
We'll absolutely have one.
Our standard disclaimer, as requested by our legal team, and that is to remind you that this podcast is not real estate advice for you personally. It is not legal advice. It is not financial advice. It's not spiritual advice or marriage advice. It's best to consider everything we talk about as humor, and that's to keep you from suing us. So if you are happy, if you are a House Einstein client, just pick up the phone and call us for advice. We'll give you our best shot at advising you on how to make a smart real estate decision with your personal situation. And if you are a listener, this podcast is entertainment.
Well said. Well, all right. Minor celebration here. We've reached the 30th podcast. Kind of exciting. I think we reignited the podcast series when we were at podcast 4, was it?
It sounds right. So yeah. A few years ago, I thought, I want to get into this podcasting thing. This sounds like a lot of fun. And I committed to doing 6 podcasts, and I think I got through 3 and decided that it wasn't fun. It was my approach to it, it was clearly not the right approach. Although I actually did engage members of the community in the podcast. It was not necessarily on topic. It was all over the place. And it took me a few years to figure out that what we really need to do is focus on our mission, and that is helping people make a smarter real estate decision. So that's mostly what this podcast is about, with entertainment in mind. Yep. And now we're on 30, which actually feels really good. We are recording pretty much every week. Next week we're going to be dark. I have some travel going on, but typically we're recording every week unless there's a holiday or some planned travel.
Yeah. By the end of the year, we should be pretty close to 80 podcasts, Oz.
That'll be fun.
That's crazy. Yeah. Excited
That's
about it.
Good intention. Let's hit 80 by the end of the year.
Easy peasy. Well,
that means taking off only 2 weeks, Hamish, for the entire year. Close to 80, I think, is a better goal, because yeah, I think that due to certain things I do and travel I have coming,
point.
There's no way we're going to hit 80. But we'll get close.
This is why you're the Einstein brain of the operation.
Yeah. Yeah. I can do the math. Okay. Quick so minutes. Let's talk about our first topic. Just inspection concessions. Mm-hmm. And planned inspection concessions in particular. So this is threading a bit of a fine line as a topic. We've been meaning to talk about it for at least the last couple of podcasts. It's been on our to-do list. And
we might have broached it before, too.
It's tricky because you have to disclose what you know that's a material defect as the seller on the seller's property disclosure here in Colorado. Every other state may have different rules around disclosures, but in Colorado, there's a standardized form. And that form is put together by the Division of Real Estate. And that is a standard legal form, and it doesn't have enough space for all the details. So our sellers will sometimes put an asterisk in the box that says notes, and we end up with a one-pager, or in some cases multi-pages, of notes to potential buyers on various topic areas related to real estate. Stuff with the structure, whether there was mold or flood damage. What do you? This is where you're supposed to write what you know about the property, and sellers often forget to write things they know.
Big air
intentionally
quotes.
Or otherwise. And by the way, real estate agents in Colorado have a proactive duty to disclose material defects. It doesn't even have to be on the property disclosure. If your agent knows that there's a structural problem and you forgot to disclose, and they know, they have to disclose it proactively. They don't have to wait. In fact, they should not wait for the buyer to say, tell me what you know. Mm-hmm. They have to tell the buyer
proactively, right?
Through the buyer's agent proactively. That's a duty that they can't get away from.
So we touched a little bit on buyer psychology when, you know, you're talking about they make an offer from the sell side perspective. They'll make an offer and it's exactly what the sellers want. Well, we typically advise not to just immediately sign it, but counter on perhaps a more minor element of it, maybe a deadline or, you know, some verbiage in the contract or something to that effect. The idea is to create a little bit of friction. Osmond, you're probably a little bit more eloquent, but the idea, right, is to make it feel like the buyers had to work a little bit more, and it wasn't just an instant win.
Am I making faces? This is not our topic, Hamish.
Well, it does. It leads into it. That's where the planned inspection concessions come from.
Okay,
right?
It does.
Because
it's fair enough.
So
I appreciate it. I just we don't want to necessarily go into too much detail on how we negotiate every deal, but it's true. What you're saying is something we do advise our clients, and that is it is usually a good idea to counter, even if the offer is better than you expected, because it's human nature to want the matrix to crash. It's human nature to expect some difficulty, and if it's too easy, then they will think something is wrong. And if you're on the sell side of the deal and you have an offer that is acceptable and you send it back and just sign it, they will, instead of rewarding you, they will punish you for giving them everything they always wanted.
And too easy.
So it's the Willy Wonka, you know what happened to the boy who got everything he always wanted? And the answer in Willy Wonka is he lived happily ever after, but it's not the answer in real estate. The answer in real estate is they become miserable and they find things wrong and the odds of the deal breaking up are much, much higher. So it's usually about price, but sometimes the price is fine. In which case, if you're grasping for something to counter on, maybe you should look at your calendar and make sure all those dates are perfect for you. We should go through that contract with a fine-tooth comb and look for legitimate items to counter on. But you really should consider countering on price in particular, but other factors in the deal too. But that brings us – that does dovetail, Hamish, to planned inspection concessions. And the reason – planned inspection concessions are challenging is that if you already knew about this problem, you probably should have disclosed it on the SPD. And in theory, if you disclose it on the SPD, the buyer shouldn't be asking you to correct it or negotiate on something they already knew about when they wrote the offer. So now you're also into the territory of bad faith negotiation, because if they got the SPD prior to writing the offer, they already knew about this problem. So why are we having this conversation after they've submitted and now we're looking at this issue and the inspection that they should have already known about? And so then it becomes a question of how much other demand is there for this house? Is there likely to be a better offer coming? And should you tell the buyer to pound sand if they're going to behave disingenuously on a known inspection issue? But the fine line for the seller is the SPD. And maintenance is not necessarily a
defect, right?
Material defect. And so we've actually had some sellers in the past, years ago, who quite intentionally left things for the inspector to find. They could have addressed every single thing. And these were minor items, so not material defects, but they knew the inspector is going to find the slight drip in the sink, right? Which has the pan under it, catching the drip.
This is where my curiosity comes from, right? What about... So keep going, sorry.
Well, so buyer expectation around inspection negotiations. So the process in Colorado is you have the initial phase where you've got the contract, the price, the dates are all set up. All of that is first phase. Second phase is they've done their inspections, and now they've found some things that they weren't expecting in the house. And what we always tell our buyers is that it really should be things you did not expect to find. It should not be visible and obvious and cosmetic issues that you knew about when you wrote the offer, when you the cracks in the driveway, the carpet stains, like those things that will show up on an inspection report are visible and obvious and really should not be now a negotiation item. So we usually tell them to stick to things that are actually surprises and stick to three or four items that are material, not the laundry list of every single thing on the inspection. But buyers usually expect to get at least the cost of their inspection back, which these days keeps creeping up. So I would expect about $1,000 to $1,500 on a typical low to mid-end deal for inspection concessions. And sometimes it gets into the threes and fives and 10,000s for higher end homes, particularly if there is a significant issue found. And if the roof is found, it can get a lot higher. If something like EFIS is found, it can be four times higher. It can be a six-figure concession. I've personally negotiated those for EFIS issues, exterior finish insulation system failures. So,
and that even gets into the loanability side of things too, doesn't it?
And there's another piece, thank you, Hamish, that we'll get there. That's in the crafting of how do we solve this problem. If the buyer has a serious issue with a material defect with the house and they want the seller to fix it, it is a requirement to disclose the resolution to the buyer's lender. Because the buyer's lender here in Colorado, and I'm not sure about the state that everyone who's listening to this podcast, I don't know about the rules in your state, but in Colorado, the lender is supposed to know about the resolution. They're not necessarily supposed to see the objection, but they have to see the resolution. It's printed on the bottom of the form. And so if you write seller must replace roof or seller will credit buyer $30,000 for roof, the lender is going to say, no.
Oops.
We're not loaning you however hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars on this house. You've got to fix the roof before closing. We need to see paid invoices for the roof fixed. And now you're into an insurance claim. And so there's like a spiral that starts to happen with solving these issues. And that is one of the things, frankly, you pay for with competent representation in the real estate world. Agents that negotiate and solve these problems, not just to the satisfaction of buyer or seller, but also make sure we navigate the narrow pathway that we're allowed to navigate with respect to the lender. And keeping all the contract dates in line and making sure we don't risk the buyer's earnest money if you're on the buy side of the deal. All of that comes into play. And good behavior usually benefits both parties. Ethical behavior, clear communication, reasonableness. Like if the furnace is bad and the inspector says your furnace is shot, it turns out it's true, the furnace is actually shot. Well, when they wrote the offer, they weren't expecting a brand new furnace. Right. There is clearly an old one when they open that utility closet. So what's a reasonable negotiation concession? A reasonable one is usually half the cost, not the full cost of an HVAC system. But sometimes buyers want to push the limit. And if the seller got their price on the original negotiation, you can bet pretty hard they're gonna threaten to walk away if they don't get their price on the furnace.
Of course, right, market dependent and demand of the property, though these are, you know, generalizations and
all
experience.
Of those things. All of those things. And sometimes the buyer just wants the house and doesn't want to risk any of these things and tells their agent, don't even bother in issuing the inspection objection. We're going to tear down the house anyway and build a new one. We don't care. And it's not worth our time to try to, you know, get $3,000 or $4,000 out of the seller when, in fact, what we really want is goodwill between them after closing so we can call them up and ask them all sorts of questions about the work they had done on the house. And we want good relationships with them, not them pissed off because aggravating them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And personal factors, by the way, can get really personal because real estate is a very personal transaction. Often we're dealing with family members and a deceased family member this is the estate sale, a house they grew up in, and how you conduct yourself is everything in these negotiations. But some of our sellers have been known to plan for inspection concessions. They knew the furnace is older. They wrote the furnace is 10 years old. And I've told them, look, they're probably going to red flag this. Mm-hmm. So in your mind, before you accept the offer price, reserve $5,000, $7,000 for right. us to arm wrestle over this. And that arm wrestling will actually tighten the deal. They're going to feel like it was a little harder. We got a little more money out of the seller. They're going to feel better about the deal. And you're going to already expect this to happen, so you're not right. going to be shocked by it. You're not going to, and the, here's the key with planned concessions in any negotiation, and that is never, ever, ever tell the other side that you expected this. Mm. Even years after closing, do not disclose that this was all intentional, the arm Part wrestling the over minor details. Yeah. yeah, because we know it's human nature to have a little difficulty in the deal will make the deal go better. If both parties are a little unhappy, the deal sticks. And if one party got railroaded, it is a high probability of the deal falling apart. So remember human nature in negotiations around price and inspection, and make sure that everything you do is in line with the contract, in line with human good nature.
Faith. Yeah,
I would strongly advise good faith. I mean, we represent our clients, and if they're behaving in bad faith, we're not going to disclose to the counterparty that we think our client is acting in bad faith ever. Because we represent their fiduciary interests. We have a fiduciary responsibility. It doesn't matter that we think our clients are awful. But with that said, almost all of our clients are lovely people, and we've learned to weed out the potential bad apples early in the process.
Which you've heard us talking about too, right?
Many times. So we're really happy with our clients. It's super rare that we have one that wants to behave unethically. But sometimes they want to negotiate really aggressively over things that we don't think are material, but that doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. It's their decision. Our job is to advise, and we have negotiated, $25,000 credits for squeaky floors. While I thought that's normal in an older house, our buyer didn't. And they rule, and we go to bat, and we negotiate aggressively, and we got them. We asked for 50, we got 25. And they were happy. I'm happy. And that agent is pissed at me probably still over that whole negotiation. She's hung up the phone on me so many times in negotiation, like mid-sentence, just slams the phone down. I won't name her in this podcast, but it is a prominent agent in town who has a lot of listings frequently.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, that was okay. Probably our highlight of 2022.
That was a fun deal. So have we covered this? Have we covered planned inspection concessions? I think we've more or less covered
that. Yeah, and if anything, it's at a high level now, and we can drill down to it in another podcast if we need
I'll
or
ask you a question,
something
Hamish.
Pops up. Yeah.
Now, and how you handled your personal inspection negotiation, because you were driving the bus for most of that deal, your first home.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have some regret about not being more aggressive, or are you happy with how it played out? Now, it's about 8 months later.
Yeah, I'm actually quite happy with how it turned out. I think for the most part, I don't like absolutes, but I really think that it was handled super well. We went in with an escalation clause, knowing that this price point is fairly competitive, and that kind of kept my offer on the table, thankfully. And then, talking about inspection-related items, I wish maybe I'd raised a few more concerns with the inspector at the review than I'd had. And also maybe a little bit more proactive with hiring out more qualified people to come and inspect after the initial inspection. That said, I'm not like the house isn't falling apart or anything. I think it would have just been better to get a little bit more compounding information before I went in, though I don't think it would have changed the outcome of where we are today. That's my general reflection on the situation, yeah.
Well, Hamish brought up a really good point, and that is the more competitive the market for a particular house, the less leverage buyers have to negotiate anything. Mm. And in fact, just getting a seat at the table and a commitment to only negotiate for serious health and safety concerns that come up on inspection is all you can hope for. And we've had multiple deals where the buyer said, we just want the house and we can't. We've already lost 14 offers. I've had those. This is a few years ago, but we've gone through 14 contracts and I've lost every time. No inspection. Waive it.
Yeah.
I'm going to roll the die on this. I want this house. And we tell them that's not a great idea, but we'll do it because you'll probably get the house, but I have no idea what else you're getting with that house.
Yeah. So I'd recommend you still get an inspection, but at the minimum, right?
Right. Well, and also talk to the neighbors, because not everything that matters to you is considered, may be considered a material defect.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, work that's been repaired may not show up on the SPD. There have been lawsuits over that, that they felt like all the issues were resolved. They didn't need to disclose it. Any homicides are not considered a material defect in the house. And I can tell you that a lot of people would want to know that somebody was murdered in the house they're about to buy.
There's a specific verbiage for it. What it's like psychological defect or something like that.
But it's not considered in Colorado anyway. Agents don't have to disclose that. So this is one of the reasons we actually strongly recommend people in the due diligence period go talk to the neighbors of the home, introduce yourself, ask about the neighborhood, ask if there's anything they know about the house. I mean, you could, in theory, ask just point blank if this homicide issue is your top priority. But you should ask, because the neighbors usually will disclose things that they shouldn't. And they love to talk. And they
don't
also
have a horse in the race, right? I mean, unless they're really wanting the neighborhood to go up. But
they usually don't have a horse in the race. So it's good due diligence to always talk to the neighbors. Do it on a nice day, on a weekend. Bring your family if you have one. And if you're not comfortable and you're our client, if you're not comfortable doing this, I will personally go with you. I think it's so important to go meet the neighbors. Whether or not you're in the mountains, anywhere, you should go meet the neighbors. But even more important in the mountains.
When I was shopping for a home, the first house we put an offer on ended up with 18 other offers. Or I was one of 18. That aside, though, I did go and chat to the neighbors. And the one that I did talk to, I mean, it was fantastic. She just went on and on and on and on about the neighborhood, who owned what, which house is a rental, you know, how the dynamic works in the neighborhood, all of these things. And it actually, you know, cemented kind of my interest in the house more than anything. I didn't do that here. but I think it would have been worth it. There's nothing in this neighborhood that's really set me back too much. So it's been good at least there.
Well, you brought up another interesting topic, and we'll save it for a future podcast. Mm-hmm. And that's how to effectively manage a multiple offer scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, if you were one of 19 offers and we actually submitted, or one of 18 offers and we actually submitted, well, the listing agent screwed up.
Yeah, we got our time wasted.
Yeah, well, we wasted a lot of time, created a lot of bad will, and really the listing agent should have been saying to every agent, look, if you're interested in this house, don't bother submitting unless your offer is above $1 million or whatever the number is.
Here's the ceiling now.
We have three offers above $1 million. If your offer is not well above $1 million, mm-hmm. we're not even going to look at it. And that's what the agent should be doing with 18 people till they get three or four offers on the table. And then they should do it again with mm-hmm. those three or four offers after they've compared them and see if they can drive that price even higher. That is the job of the listing agent. But when they brag about getting 18, 19 offers, I know they're incompetent.
Yep.
Because you should never be. It takes so much time to go through 19 contracts. You should have been encouraging only the strongest to submit, and it totally mishandled. 100%.
I've got more thoughts, but we will save that for another pod.
Okay.
Yep. All right. I don't want to give it all away. So.
All right, we'll save it for a future pod. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the sale of the week.
Let's do it. A little early in the podcast than usual. Kind of a nice change.
That's right. Yeah. Well, it happens to be our listing. And it's a listing that I honestly took with such sadness because we represented them when they acquired the home. And it's one of the most architecturally distinctive and interesting homes I've had an opportunity to help a buyer acquire. And It's such a cool property. I was so excited to get the listing, but also sad because they only had the house for a few years and they did well with the home. But I was sad to see their decision to focus their residence on their property in town.
Hmm.
And the listing itself, we're talking about 340 South Peak.
Yep.
And it's closed it's now closed. Closed January 2nd. Probably the first closing for land title in Boulder since our appointment was 9 a.m.
That's a good
point. So like the first child of the year, 340 South Peak was the first sale for land title this year, first sale for House Einstein this year, first closing. And
The home was designed by, so you could pull this up on Zillow if you're listening, or realtor.com. The home was designed by a Boulder dentist and family. It was their dream home, and they lived there for many years. And after they passed away, it's had a couple of different owners, very well-known people, but was not built for spec purposes. It was not built
all
for profit. And the design of it nailed so many of the boxes for mountain homes. Built in 1999, I believe, and I'm going on memory. It has tall ceilings. It does not feel like these 70s era boxes that you find in the mountains frequently that try to compete with these newer homes. The design is an aesthetic that is still very contemporary.
Mm-hmm.
Large windows, but with key, and this is a key distinction, with a significant overhang. When you face south, you want those large windows to let the light in, but in the summer, you want that overhang so you don't bake.
Yeah.
And the home had concrete, colored concrete flooring for a passive heating system, had active solar and hot water solar,
mm-hmm.
had so much going on. So triple solar systems in this house, and was built really robustly, and I thought such a fun house to entertain in. And of course, the views were just mind-blowing. So it was always fun to go up there and show the home. And it finally closed.
Yeah. Yeah, we made quite a decent amount of content on this home, and just recently the closing video for it. And it's an interesting one because it's very striking in person and on photos and in video. Though I find myself with the drone, there's only, you know, so many shots you can get, and there's this tree right in the center. And it's fantastic when you're entertaining because the tree kind of adds this, like, treetops feel and everything, but you really had to get close with the drone. A few times when I went up, it was so windy, the drone was basically at, like, a 45-degree angle just to counteract to the force of the wind. And I was thinking about, you know, getting up close to the balcony. I was like, yeah, maybe we'll hold off for a better day.
Yeah. And Hamish is a licensed pilot, for the record, and knows what he's doing behind the drone and behind the camera.
Yeah.
So let's also be intellectually honest, because I feel like transparency is really helpful for people. When we first listed this home, we listed high.
Mm-hmm.
I was fairly convinced that the market was still pretty strong. We did most of our analysis in May, and we went live June 1st at 1.9, which... given the competition at the time, made total sense.
Right.
The market and the competitors were just sitting there for most of the summer and then started to drop, and we had to chase the market down, which is not my favorite thing to do, which is one of the reasons I strongly prefer listing in the first and second quarter, because you have a lot more time to make these sort of adjustments versus the very end of the
swing.
The second quarter. You're basically catching the tailwind of the market by June. So if it's possible to list, you should always try to list by March. But with that said, once it was pretty clear that the 1.9 price wasn't there, we started to cut. And we made one, two, three price reductions. Yeah. So one at about a month, $75,000. About 90 days later, we cut it to 1.69. And then one more small cut at the beginning of October at 1.675. And it closed for 1.6. I think the buyers got an amazing deal on that house.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing else is close to it in that price range in the mountains within a 20-minute drive of the city of Boulder. And I know because I've looked at virtually every single listing. And you could even add $200,000 on top of that price, and you still wouldn't find a house as nice as this one. So I feel... a little bit sad, like if we had listed in March, it would have been better. Or if we listed even this year, they probably would see a higher number. But that's what happens on the downwind of the market. And sometimes timing is not in your favor, but they still did really fine. I mean, they acquired the house at just over 1.35. So there was still plenty of cushion there. You know, as a former investment analyst, I'm constantly thinking about the
margin.
The IRR.
Oh yeah.
They did fine. The margin, the profitability, they did fine. But I really was hoping they got the 1.9 because I think that house deserved it. And we sure as heck marketed the heck out of it. So here's something I want to distinguish us with: that not only do we do fantastic photography and videography, but we're paying for traffic, local traffic, to see that on social media platforms. And one of the things you should always ask your listing agent is, what are they doing to increase viewership? If the property doesn't sell right away, you know, through the magic listing service, the MLS, well, what are you doing to increase people that wouldn't have otherwise come to see this house to come see it? And we were producing amazing content. That was mostly you, Hamish. You did an amazing job. And we had a significant budget towards driving traffic at this property. And that's why if you go to YouTube and you go to our House Einstein, and this is just one, go to our channel. This is just one of our, you know, platforms that we put content on. How many views do we have, Hamish? You could pull this up faster than me.
Yeah, we were at 16,000.
Yeah. 616?
Yep.
Yeah. That's a lot of views for one house on YouTube. And a large portion of that is paid traffic from our local market. We're not advertising nationally for the house.
Yeah, keeping it local, keeping it to the audience that might actually see it and have an interest is pretty key. I think the fair housing restrictions on advertising for social media are fairly strict. And so a tendency to see is a lot of people just say, screw it, let Facebook decide or let Google decide and we'll just send it the budget. Though you can't specifically target, and there's good reason for that, right, fair housing. You can still keep it local. And so that's an important distinction that we've worked on.
And let's remember that fair housing topic when we talk about Beyonce and Jay-Z.
Good point.
Because that deal is so large, and it looks like it was a whisper listing.
Mm-hmm.
And whisper listings carry massive liability for a fair housing lawsuit.
Yeah, well, hey, that's a good point, too. We're talking about our social media advertising and getting out in front of a lot of people. Not whisper listing, right? We're trying to get the whole market going. We're not just for the sneaky exclusive buzzword of a pocket listing.
I think we've talked about pocket listings before and all the pros and cons. Mostly they're cons to pocket listings. But the idea of marketing in general with real estate is to have the largest funnel of qualified people seeing this house. And sometimes you get buyers that weren't even really looking to buy a home. They just just caught their eye. And then they schedule a showing with us. And next thing you know, they're writing an offer. That happens more often than you would think, people buying homes on a whim, it sounds like. I mean, maybe they were thinking about it. They've got an empty nest. In this particular case, these buyers are relocating, or they have relocated from Texas, and they were just here at the right time, and we happen to have the listing available, and the weather cooperated, and the views sparkled, and they got it right away. So it really is just about having as big of a funnel of qualified buyers as possible, get as many people in the door to see the home, and then that increases your probability of selling the home. So this brings us to feedback and competitive benchmark, competitive landscape benchmarking that we now do with all of our listings. And we used to just rely on automated feedback, and realizing how poor the quality of that feedback had been, we stopped doing that. And I think the email still goes out, but we should just turn it off at this point, Hamish, because it's useless feedback. It's just busy work, and it never adds value. So we started calling every single agent that shows the house. We try to do that within 48 hours to get their feedback, get them on the phone, ask them what they thought was right, what was wrong, what we should do to improve the home. If their client's not interested, of course, that's always our first question. Is your client interested? If they are, we're not going to ask what's wrong with the house. We're going to talk about how to bring an offer together.
Mm.
But if they say, no, my client didn't want it for this reason or that, or I was just doing a preview and snuck in there, that's fine. Why don't you tell me what you thought of the house and how do we make this look better? Do you think the pricing's right? Is there anything that was off? And you might be surprised the quality of the feedback when it's solicited personally on a phone call with other agents that are local in this market. You're in the club. They want to take care of the club, and the feedback is usually pretty good.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, the grumpier the agent tends to be, the more honest and actual the feedback too. So a little bit of thick skin there, but as long as you can tough it out, then you're like, you get some seriously valuable feedback.
It's not really a four bedroom.
Yeah.
It's missing a closet. You wasted my time. Like, it was in the listing that the fourth bedroom is non-conforming, but okay. Thank you for the feedback. But sometimes you really get quality feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And now we keep a feedback log. So every showing, we'll call agents two or three times to try to get them to call us back. Not everyone does.
Even text. Yep.
But we'll provide that feedback log on a regular basis for our sellers so they actually know what the rest of the market is thinking and they can see us doing our job. Mm-hmm. And we're not just sitting there waiting for an offer. We're actually doing something for our commission, which you'd be surprised how few agents do. And then the other thing we regularly do, which is usually every other week or every week, which is competitive landscape benchmarking. And the question is, what's the competitive landscape for your particular house that we're trying to sell? What are the most likely competitors? How have they adjusted their pricing? Are there any new competitors? Have I personally gone to see them? And how does this affect the marketability of our listing? And that's every other week is usually adequate, sometimes every week, to give the seller a sense of what's happening in the marketplace.
There was,
otherwise, you're just shooting blind.
There was a home at the same time we were going live with this one that you and the sellers had gone to check out. Do you remember the name of it? Or the road,
or I don't remember the address, but it was a really interesting home, and we agreed this home was worth more.
Mm-hmm.
And when they cut their price dramatically from like 2.1 to 1.9 something, we're like, that sucks.
Yeah.
Now we have to adjust. And that house looked like it was right out of Gone with the Wind. No, not Gone with the Wind. With what's that Julie Andrews movie?
Oh, I know. I'm ready to look it up once you remember it.
Sound of Music. It was like the Sound of Music house where they're frolicking in the Alpine countryside, which you shouldn't be doing on the tundra, but they were. And that's what it looked like all around this house. It was Sound of Music, Julie Andrews skipping through the Alpine meadow, views for miles. I mean, unreal. Also, exposure for huge miles, like wind exposure.
Yeah.
No garage. All these other problems with this house, but it, given the land size, it was worth a lot more. And the address isn't really relevant, but that was one we had to go see.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the competitive landscape benchmarking. And as far as social media goes, as you pointed out, Hamish, in our notes, other agents are doing it more.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think it's a minor or very small number
mm-hmm.
that do anything beyond stick it on the MLS with some halfway decent photos. A lot of them aren't even doing staging consultations. It's really shocking. And that's the opportunity on our end is how to market better and show you how we're marketing better. It's not just...
As we say, too, it's competition. That. So, you know, I kind of welcome it. I get to see more of their ads. I get to see what they're doing. You know, how can we tweak it? How can we make it work for us? What can we do differently? It's kind of a welcome to the scene topic, you know?
Yep.
So, yeah.
We're a learning organization. I really would like us to always function as a meritocracy as well. But we learn from our competitors, and when the competitors improve, we improve more. So that's our philosophy on how we play in the world of business. And I guess a couple of last notes on this deal, but then we can move on. So the buy side was super professional in all of their communication, and that made the deal go so much smoother. You know, they were diligent. They followed up on things that when they asked for them, if they didn't get them right away, they emailed again a couple of days later. Do you have this? Every deal in the mountains that has a septic system has to have a septic smart certificate from Boulder County, if it's in Boulder. And other counties have other rules around septic, but he followed up and was not going to let this deal close without it. So he was very thorough. A lot of agents would have just forgotten about it.
Yeah.
And we were working on it, so it's not like it wasn't going to happen, but it also was helpful to have him. And because the buy side was so reasonable and professional, the seller wrote them a very nice note on all the systems of the house, who they used for snow removal, how to think about the heating system, because if you set the thermostat at 70 and your home is 70 in the morning, it's going to be 80 by afternoon. So you actually want to set your thermostat a lot lower because of how much passive solar the house gets.
Mm-hmm. Seven different thermostats. Really kind. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of thermostats in that house. And a seller who's an engineer and, you know, toyed with it until he got it the way he wanted it and then was willing to share that knowledge.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, every home has its little kind of unique characteristics to it. So I'm thinking, right, if I was to ever sell this home, you know, seeing that letter, what would I put in mine? And it's just, it's cool to see. That's real kind of seller-buyer handoff that you like to see in the deal. Versus, you're on your own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Do you feel complete with this? Shall we move on to our next topic du jour?
Let's do it.
All right. Let's do it. So, Hamish, why don't you tell us what's happening at House Einstein?
Well, we're beginning the rollout, or well, not a rollout. We're right now beginning pre-development of our newer website. And if you couldn't tell, our website was based on Blogger from Google, their kind of format, which made a lot of sense. Osman has primarily been blogging for the better part of 20 years with a load of really high-quality articles. And it's getting to the point now where we're like, okay, we might want to modernize a little bit, you know, get the mobile website a little bit more user-friendly, start putting a little bit more attention towards home pages, landing pages, and lead capture for our agents, and just general kind of aesthetic improvements. So it's just been kind of like a almost exciting and refreshing entry into 2024 as we get to... It's like cleaning a room, you know? You always feel a little bit fresher going into it, so... There's that excitement about organizing it and making it just a lot more user-friendly. And we've solicited some design feedback from agents on the team. And we're working closely with the same person who helped us develop the website the first time around. And she's been awesome. So it's just a really exciting kind of work in 2024 project.
Yep.
Yeah.
Hope to have it live maybe by the early part of the second quarter. That's what it looks like at this point, but that's easier said than done because we value the feedback and opinions of every agent on the team. We want to make sure they have an opportunity to opine and direct what the future of our branding looks like at our primary website, which is just houseeinstein.com. Mm. We also are putting content out all these other platforms, but houseeinstein.com should be functioning better for an archive of fantastic content about local real estate. Should also host every single one of our videos, should be available there. Every single one of our fresh listings, our notable sales, not fresh listings, should be on there. And that's from our fresh listings newsletter where we talk critically about
fresh listings.
Sales in Denver and Boulder. Yeah, sign up for our fresh listings newsletter if you haven't. If you want more info on that, check it out. It's online. But it is fun. It is really an opportunity to modernize an aesthetic, but I don't think we necessarily are drifting that far from our content. We'll probably include more of our content. We'll actually make it to the blog.
Mm-hmm.
And I should stop calling it the blog. More of our content will make it to our website.
Yeah.
And we'll probably include search so that you can directly access the MLS from our website without having to go to Zillow or anywhere else. I mean, that'll be a test. I don't know if we'll stick with that or not. I haven't had a searchable website for the MLS in 15 years, 17 years. And I paid a lot for it back in the day and got very few actual leads.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're competing with Redfin and Zillow. It's sort of like...
And they're kind of the gorillas, right?
Yeah. I think people just want to see that there's search. I don't know. I'm still on the fence about search. We'll see how it complements.
Yeah, discussing a question. Most podcasts don't have a comment section, though on the YouTube platform there is. If there's any elements that you particularly like in a website or drives you crazy, like a pop-up sign-up form on the website, you know, those like you go on Sears, I think it is, and it's like throw in your email for 20% off immediately. Not a huge fan of that. Yeah, little things. Always curious to see what our listeners are, what their thoughts are.
Yep. You'll find this podcast also on Apple Podcasts and other places, but YouTube is one of the few places you can actually leave us a comment directly on the podcast itself. So please do so if you have comments, or just email us feedback, or pick up the phone and call me.
Yeah.
Okay. So what else is happening here?
I'm still on the thinking about the website side of things. My largest excitement for it, I think, is we're going to be able to really effectively consolidate all of our different types of content, right? Because at this point, we've got audio podcasts, we've got video, short form, long form, and blog content. And it's almost like Burger King, but real estate your way instead of have it your way. And I think we can really elegantly implement this. So it's kind of just a neat thing to be working on.
Okay. Yeah. Sounds good. But please don't ever compare us to Burger King.
Fine.
I don't know what restaurant we are, but I like it.
We're not Burger
your
King.
Way is definitely, definitely something we're trying to do is broaden, well, consolidate, I guess, have a central place to see all these different types of content, but.
Not Burger King.
Yeah.
How dare you?
Maybe Carl's Jr. No, still not the right.
No. We'll come back to that on another pod.
I think the best burgers, by the way, are Santos. So we'll call it Santos. You can get the green chili burger, the hatch green chilies in their burger. It's spectacular.
Huh.
I'll have to All right. Free shout out to Santo.
Yeah.
And Chef Hosea.
Not sponsored.
Not sponsored. Okay. Well, I'll take the lead on the next topic if you're ready, Hamish.
Go for it.
And we've got a number of new listings that are in play. And it's, as always, there's this moment of, should we really sell the house? And that's happening for a number of our sellers because it's emotional selling a home, especially one that you have raised family in. And homes are fantastic investments in the long run. Rates are really high right now, so acquiring a new home may not be a solid investment. It might be a great personal investment in your home, but maybe not a good income-producing investment because of interest rates. But that's not the decision they're facing. The decision they're facing is whether to keep this home that they likely have a very low mortgage on. They have a lot of equity in, and it's in one of the best real estate markets in the country. So what I usually tell my clients, and I'll start our call this afternoon with one of them the same way, you're selling an asset, an investment asset in one of the best real estate markets in the country. So I can't take my investment advisor hat off. If you bought the house well, it's probably a good idea to keep it. Now, there's a whole lot of factors with regard to that because property management is not passive. It's an active process, and you will have to be responsive to your tenant in the middle of the night when the water heater breaks. You will have to be responsive when they flush things they shouldn't have flushed. You'll have to build them back for that if they damage something. And then, of course, you take on additional liability and headache. And the number of stories I can share on this topic are
numerous,
are mind-numbingly long. But I've had tenants spill hair dye on the carpets, drag furniture without pads across floors, creating gouges and thousands of dollars of damage. I've been in houses where tenants' cats peed everywhere and destroyed the subfloor. Like, we're talking about such big numbers, not just the surface flooring. So is there a chance your tenants are going to cook meth in the house? Is there a chance your tenants are going to do all these things that potentially can destroy the value of your real estate? We've had tenants ignore water leaks because they attempted to fix it themselves, and now you've got a mold problem.
Yeah.
It goes on and on. We have tenants that don't want to leave when you're getting ready to sell it and might fight an eviction. Tenants that stop paying the rent. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on for all the ways renters can really screw you over as a landlord.
It's just don't believe the myth of it being a passive income, because it's really anything but. You know, you luck out. You first off are selective in who you choose to be your tenants, but even then, you don't know. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and here's another piece that, as you just discovered today, Hamish, there's a disclosure that we're now required to give tenants in the city of Boulder that says, hey, Boulder will pay for your legal defense if you should ever decide to stop paying your rent.
Yep.
And they're facing eviction. Well, guess what? Boulder will now pay for you to have an attorney who will...
You're entitled.
Are you kidding?
Yeah.
Right. Guess who's paying the other side of that? The landlord. And guess who's going to pay for it as well? The tenants, in terms of higher rent, ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of, renting in Boulder is not for the faint of heart. But I still think it's a great investment. And if you can manage all those risks and get a property manager you're really happy with, if you're not going to manage it yourself, it could be the best thing you ever did. You could pay for your kids' college education with this asset.
Yeah. And at the minimum, you're building equity as the years go by. You know.
Holy cow, we skipped. We skipped ahead, should you sell or rent it out? We forgot to talk about our incoming and relocating buyers.
I wondered.
Sorry, Hamish. It's just a natural segue there.
Yeah.
So let me just touch on that really quick. We do have a number of buyers also coming into the market. Some of them are relocations. Some of them have decided they want to rent here before they buy, which we strongly encourage as well. It's one of the best way to learn about neighborhoods and do your due diligence, but it does have a cost that comes with a double move. Most people don't want to do that. They want to buy the home and move into the home that they that will be their home here in Boulder, not their 12-month home or 6-month home in here right. in Boulder. And there you have to choose an agent that actually you feel comfortable working with you, that can advise you on all the neighborhoods and help you navigate it. It's hard to find somebody like that. And so if you're feeling uncomfortable buying in a relo, you should just rent. Mm-hmm. It's the right answer.
Yep. Get a feel for the area. Find a spot that speaks to you or, you know, go from there. If you can manage it.
What we do for relos?
Well, if you haven't heard in our other podcasts, we film on a gimbaled camera, typically 4K, usually 1080 if it's super time sensitive. But within 48 hours, we'll get you a roughly 40 to an hour and 10 minutes, I think is the longest we've gone, video touring the house, not just showing you what's great, but any material defect that we spot or any item of concern, we'll highlight it in the video. And get you at least the most detailed video that we can provide within 48 hours. I don't think we've been outside of 24 hours even for the past 5 videos. So
I know, I just would rather underpromise. One of these videos is going to show up at a time where you're slammed.
I know.
Slammed, and we'll be like, 48 hours is what is reasonable, but we usually are within 24.
Well within, yeah.
I mean, that gives you an opportunity to see a house remotely and hop on a flight if you're serious about the house. Mm-hmm. And there's other strategic decisions we could talk about, but that's an off-podcast topic mm-hmm. for our clients, not for the general public. But that is an offering that we do have for relo people.
Yeah.
All right. Should we bounce back to landlord land?
Let's do it.
Okay. So we talked about all the things that can screw up a house. We didn't really go too far into liability, but you'll definitely want to up your coverages if you're going to become a landlord. And one of the big benefits, though, is tax deductibility. So the entire tax code in the United States is set up to benefit homeownership, from the deductibility of interest on your personal mortgage to depreciation on your investment properties that you will then pay recapture on or 1031 exchange into another property and defer paying the gains. The taxes on the gains. I mean, there's so many ways to parlay real estate. You can borrow against the asset at usually very favorable interest rates. And that's what most people do, is they borrow against their real estate assets. It's like borrowing against your investment portfolio without selling it. It's really remarkable how much of our economic system is set up around owning real estate. So mm-hmm. keeping it has a lot of advantages. And I think probably one of our clients' concerns right now is, and you pointed this out, Hamish, is timing.
Yeah.
And the market, there's all this bad news out there. The market's so bad, maybe you shouldn't. It's a horrible time to buy. I think the market's about to explode as interest rates drop. And it might be a great time to sell your house. And
knocking
it
might
be a pretty good time to buy and refi into a lower rate. So, but there's a third option. And that's list the home. Doesn't sell at the price you wanted. Okay. Well, we're going to list it probably, this one that we're meeting on, we're probably listing in March. If it's not under contract by June 1st or June 15th, well, then it's time to go into property management land. And that is something we actually offer our clientele. If we helped you buy the house, we will likely take you on as a landlord and manage the house for you. So that'll be a topic of conversation. So it actually isn't, it's the classic blunder. You know, it's not an either or decision. It could be both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you got to keep in mind, too, you hear so much talk about down market, up market, and everything, which may be true on kind of the larger time scale, though there still exists the seasonal cycle. And even in a super high rate environment, you're typically going to see more listings towards the beginning of the year versus later. The school season's still going to kind of suck to list your home, and there's still typically bargains towards the end of the year. Like that smaller cycle still exists within the larger picture.
You know, I mean, you could potentially time the seasonal market better.
Mm-hmm.
You could also time the larger market cycle better.
Yeah.
Real estate historically is both seasonal and cyclical.
Exactly.
And I think that we're now at the end of a down cycle. although it didn't impact Boulder very much. It did impact lots of other markets in the country, and likely the market's going to be moving upward again by summer. But no one really knows. No one knows what Powell's going to do with rates. And the 10-year treasury closely, well, the 30-year fixed closely tracks that 10-year treasury. And I think it could be down another 0.75 points, almost a full 1% by the end of summer. But it could also just not go anywhere and just be where it is now. So hard to say.
Keeping, no one has a crystal ball. Keeping renting in the back of your pocket, right?
It should always be a consideration. Mm-hmm. Like if you own a home and for whatever reason you plan to move out of it and maybe buy another one, should you sell it or should you rent it? You should always consider both options and have an honest conversation around managing this property and all the downsides that can happen. And I strongly think it's one of the best ways to accumulate wealth. As an investor myself, but I also think it's not a free lunch. The active investment is real, and you should consider your alternatives, because selling the house doesn't mean you're taking the proceeds and setting it on fire. It means you're investing it in something else. Well, what are you investing it in? Because maybe your alternative investment is better and comes with less risk and less active management, less hassle factor mm-hmm. than owning real estate. And if that's the context of the decision that makes sense, it's not a just take the cash and run and, you know.
Yeah.
It's not an instant win. Sneakers. I mean, what are you doing with the money? Are you putting it in your IRA? Are you putting it in your, are you putting it in the S&P 500?
Are you funding your world trip? You know?
Are you buying Bitcoin?
I've been hearing more murmurs okay. about crypto lately. I'm,
oh, yeah. Every time it goes high, so we've had a big gain this year, all the crypto people get super excited yeah. and want to shove it in your face. But where were they 2 years ago? They weren't so happy real 2 years silent. Ago.
Yeah.
High risk and maybe high return.
Strange or maybe high fundamentals, loss. Yeah.
Not our topic.
No.
Bitcoin.
And okay. entertainment anyway. Back to the discussion.
Entertainment anyway. True.
Yeah.
All right. So let's finalize this. Let's wrap up the podcast and talk about the power couple,
yes,
who acquired the most expensive, well, had the most expensive transaction in 2023, the number one transaction. And this, I'm going to paraphrase a little bit of this article from the Wall Street Journal. It was published yesterday by E.B. Solomont. And it's titled that Beyonce and Jay-Z's Malibu buy top the charts. And the subline says, deep-pocketed buyers kept the luxury sector chugging along as the overall market struggled under the weight of inflation and high mortgage rates. And we definitely saw that here in Boulder. I did an analysis, I think it was September,
yeah.
maybe early October, just to see year over year how many plus $3 million homes sold in Boulder. And I was surprised to see that more had sold and that likely we were going to beat out the target, beat out the full year pretty easily. For plus three. And of course, this is not plus three. So Beyonce, they spent $190 million. So let me read you a little bit of this article. So this home was designed by a Japanese architect named Tadao Ando. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And there are fewer than 20 homes designed by this famous architect in the United States. And so they shelled out $190 million for this house in Malibu, which has now, according to the journal, cemented the architect's cult-like status among celebrities. The house spans 42,000 square feet,
jeez.
Sits on a bluff, roughly 8 acres, and is made of reinforced architectural concrete. It was designed for collectors Maria and Bill Bell, who spent $14.5 million on the land in 2003, so 20 years ago. So 20 years of appreciation just for the land. So think about that.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's on a bluff, so think about climate change. And then a bluff overlooking the sea. You know, those are kind of known to not be so stable. I wonder if Beyonce and Jay-Z did their homework on that.
Yeah, I'm curious.
But this eclipsed the sales record for California, which was $177 million of the compound next door by Mark Andreessen and his wife. In 2021. So who really, Hamish, who needs 42,000 square feet of house?
You're asking
42,000 square of heating and cooling and fixtures and furniture and it's just
I've got
it's
really
like a house for people that hate. It's a house for people that hate each other. Like you're not gonna need to, you're never gonna need to see the other person in this home anywhere.
I'm just thinking about acoustics. You've got both of them singing. Looks very echoey in there.
Yeah. So here's some interesting facts about the deal. According to the Wall Street Journal, the list price of this home was actually $295 million, but it was a so-called whisper listing. So when I see whisper listing, I usually conclude somebody overpaid or somebody stole the house. And we're talking about a sale price of $105 million below the supposed list price. So that gives Beyonce and Jay-Z maybe a feeling like they stole the home, right? They got $100 million off. But
aren't they both $100 million off?
I
know Jay-Z know is. I'm not sure on Beyonce.
Probably. I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, maybe they just have too much money. That's another argument. But let's just talk about pocket or whisper listings. I usually tell my clients it's a bad idea because the whole market is not seeing this home, and you probably could sell it for a lot more if the whole market did see this home. You also risk a fair housing lawsuit if somebody gets really upset that they never got a shot at this house because you sold it to Beyonce and Jay-Z through your private, you know, whisper network, but you didn't sell it to me, and I have an ethnicity and religion different than Beyonce and Jay-Z, and clearly it's discrimination because you didn't show it to the whole market, so I want $100 million of damages because
right.
I wasn't given the opportunity to buy this house. I mean, this high number pocket whisper listing is, frankly, I would encourage my – if I had been representing Bill and Maria Bell, I would have told them it's not a good idea. But there's such a sense of exclusivity. Like exclusive thing creates this sense of value that is fake in most cases. I mean, you could argue that with only 19 homes in the U.S. designed by this guy, Tadao Ando, that it is exclusive. He may not build another one, right? Mm-hmm. So there is exclusivity there. Maybe it's 100% worth it. Not entirely sure. But it's certainly an interesting deal at the very high end. And 8 acres on a bluff that hopefully won't erode next week and hopefully won't be taken out in a major hurricane or typhoon-type storm or tsunami that's driven by climate change. Oceanfront, I mean, I worked in oceanfront property back on Nantucket. It was always on my mind because the... there's one side of the island that is collapsing, and they've moved so many homes. That's on a bluff.
Oh, really?
And they've moved house after house away from the bluff. There's been battles over that side of the island over whether you can put in sand tubes and other types of geoengineering to keep the bluff from eroding further. There's factors. I hope that they got their due diligence on buying on a bluff. I hope they
did
their homework.
It's always curious... what the strategy is there. And again, like, I don't know their motivations. I don't have the budget or can see nearly all of the opportunities I think are afforded to you at these price points. But there's, I don't know. I wonder, right? Cause once sea levels or coastlines start eroding in a much more aggressive fashion, obviously the sale value is gone. So what's your goal? Are you planning on holding on to it for 10 years and then getting rid of it 5 years before things start really going south? Or what's the play?
And that's my wife Leah has brought that up with me repeatedly, that she's just shocked that people buy beachfront property. And I think that their drivers for their purchase are different.
Mm-hmm.
They are not worried about 40 years from now. They want to enjoy the home for five and plan to sell it after. And even if they lose $190 million, it's irrelevant in the context of their overall wealth. And it's insured, so don't worry about it and move on. Although the insurance company is looking at that and be like, how much do we charge them per year that makes money for us? And then when should we cancel that insurance policy?
Right.
Before we – like how many years should we charge an insane amount to insure this home? It's a very interesting thing. There's also this – you know, kind of a ick factor with people spending that much on real estate. And on one hand, I got to say, I think people should spend whatever they spent. They earned it. It's their money. They're not under any specific duty to share some of that wealth with other people. They're, you know, I just find conspicuous consumption to be kind of gross. It's just how I was raised. Mm-hmm. But I'll represent. I mean, if they called me and said, "Osman, we're looking at buying this property," I'd gladly fly out on their private jet to go look at it. But I still, you know, internally, I got to admit, I find gross consumption, well, a little gross. That level of consumption, a little gross.
Yeah. And I mean, what it's called Billionaire's Row is the subdivision or street that they're on, and it's very. And I watched this documentary, I think it was last year, about some of the high rises in New York being built more for status symbols than actually even lived in. And you got to wonder if it's kind of a similar thing, which is just strange.
Oh, probably. Yeah, it's a status symbol.
Yeah.
100%.
I didn't want to be too snarky or, you know, holier than thou or anything, but you asked me what 40,000 square foot's good for, and I was like, I don't know, an orphanage, you know, something that would benefit people. But
yeah, it would be great for taking care of homeless people or saving puppies or...
Yeah, good library.
An entire business out of. I mean, that's a massive building.
Be an awesome rec center.
A lot of square footage. Yeah. I'm sure they have recording studios and anything they want. It's cool. Mm-hmm. And it is a beautiful property. There's no doubt. I just find it kind of funny.
I'm a tech guy.
I'll tell you, if I had a billion or billions to spend on anything, I would not buy a property that would put me at number one.
Mm-hmm.
I just because I feel like that would make you such a target in all sorts of ways for nut jobs in your life.
I've had like this back of my head designing a house in my imagination thing for like the past 8 years or so, and it's on a bluff, but it doesn't look even remotely like these houses. And considering the price tag, I don't know. It's got the architect branding and all these things to it. But if I'm paying this much, I'd want a little bit more personality, my own personality in the house, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Design your own home.
Right.
Build the one of your dreams. Spend 10 years making it perfect for you and your family and your friends. Well, all right. I think we put a nail in this. Yeah. Each to their own. We hope that Beyonce and Jay-Z are really happy in the home. And if they're not, call me. We'll help. Find them a better one.
Yeah, you'll get licensed in California, no problem.
Right, no problem. I'll just make that license happen.
Yeah.
But with all of that said, let's wrap this up. So if you've listened this far, thank you so much for being a listener of the podcast. If you like our content, you will find us at houseeinstein.com, where you can subscribe to our newsletter. It comes out about once a month. And if you're serious about buying or selling property in Colorado, we primarily serve Boulder and Denver and some of the resort towns that are adjacent to us, as well as Longmont. We actually go as far as Fort Collins. We just did close the deal in Golden. But this is our footprint. It's mostly Front Range from the South Denver suburbs all the way to Fort Collins. And then occasionally we're dabbling in the mountains because I think it's really fun and interesting, and we're happy to help you engage on that front too. And you will find us at houseeinstein.com.
Yep. And I think you said subscribe, but also like and comment if you have any cool website stuff. Awesome.
Thank you so much, and Happy New Year.